KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Final okay is stalled in Congress on a bill setting up the Truth and Healing Commission for Indian Boarding School Policies. This week, a tribal leader in Wisconsin asked state legislators for help in getting that measure passed. Chuck Kornbach of station WUWM reports.
The bipartisan legislation would establish a federal commission to investigate the U.S. government's role in Indian boarding school systems, an era that began during the 1800s. The measure would also lead to more research into the school's effect on Native American communities and help identify pathways to healing from the cultural genocide critics of the schools say the institutions were designed to commit. Late last year, the U.S. Senate passed the measure, but the House of Representatives has yet to do so. During an annual State of Wisconsin Tribes speech to the Wisconsin legislature, St. Croix Chippewa Indians of Wisconsin chairman Thomas Fowler spoke about the topic. He urged the Republican-controlled state body to encourage the GOP-controlled House to act on the bill, calling it critical for Native communities.
The tragedy of boarding schools requires remembrance so that the spirits of our ancestors are not lost or forgotten. We have a duty to afford them dignity and respect, to address the loss they suffered, oftentimes while being alone.
Fowler says he's not trying to criticize all of today's non-Indian politicians for what happened in the past.
I recognize that not all the people in this room are responsible for those detrimental past policies. But each of us have an opportunity and, quite frankly, an obligation to ensure that history never repeats itself.
The U.S. Catholic bishops have wanted representation on the Boarding Schools Commission. The bishops say that healing and reconciliation are only possible if all parties are involved. St. Croix Chairman Fowler also called on the Wisconsin legislature to support additional state policies expanding Native American education and legalizing medical marijuana. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Alaska experts on energy, housing, and infrastructure say billions of dollars in limbo from President Trump's federal funding freezes are affecting local projects like heat pump distribution and building infrastructure to protect against storm surges and tsunamis. Representatives from Alaska-based organizations held a joint press conference last week. They said more than $5 billion are at risk from the bipartisan infrastructure law and over $720 million from the Inflation Reduction Act. Those numbers are a moving target, given some programs have been frozen and unfrozen irregularly. Tashina Duddle works at Deerstone Consulting, which supports tribal energy infrastructure projects across Alaska. She says many grants that are now frozen were for projects to prevent shore erosion and stabilize villages against permafrost melt and flooding. One program through the Bureau of Indian Affairs supports tribally led climate adaptation. It's allocated $72 million in funding for nearly 40 Alaskan tribal projects, but is now on pause.
Without this funding, villages will be lost to erosion, infrastructure will collapse under worsening climate conditions, communities will have to relocate without a plan, without resources, and without dignity.
Duddle adds that the projects also create crucial economic opportunities in rural communities, like construction jobs. Agencies are unsure what projects will be able to move forward and what spending will be reimbursed. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
As currently constructed and described before the Finance Committee, does not grow agriculture, it grows government.
Legislators reject a proposal from the governor to create a Department of Agriculture. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Fairbanks residents gathered to share concerns with Senator Dan Sullivan, though indirectly.
We also do realize that, you know, his schedule's really packed. At the same time, these are really tense times, and you're our senator. We feel like you should meet with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Several North Slope residents are trying to remove the local borough mayor from office for what they say is misuse of public funds. The group filed an application for a recall petition for Josiah Putkatuk early this month and a court complaint last week. The Alaska Desk's Alona Nyden reports.
The group says that North Slope Borough Mayor Josiah Alaksarak Putkatuk received compensation from the borough for what they call lavish travel expenses on business trips that often included his family. The assembly adjusted borough code in December to clearly allow compensation for family travel, but that came after Putkatuk was paid tens of thousands of dollars for at least 15 trips with his family, both domestic and international. Marietta Aiken is one of the residents involved in the recall efforts.
Everybody, even the mayor, has to follow rules and regs and procedures. Him being the number one leader, he should be setting an example. He thinks that those standards does not apply to him, but they do.
The group submitted their first recall application in February, but the clerk's office denied it, saying it failed to meet grounds for a recall. The authors filed a new application on March 4th, which the borough has not responded to yet. On Friday, one of the residents filed a complaint with the Utqiagvik court asking that the borough be directed to issue a recall petition. The application is now being reviewed by an outside counsel, says the borough's spokesperson, Angela Cox. Cox responded via email to a list of questions and a request for comment. Putkatuk, who is also a former state representative, was elected as mayor in the fall of 2023. His travel history shows that the borough paid to fly his family, often in first class, to Anchorage, Seattle, New York, and North Slope villages. He also took them on an 11-day trip to Peru for a whaling convention. Beverly Akakugo, a retired Inupiaq language teacher, filed the court complaint.
The mayor's family is not the borough's responsibility.
Cox with the borough said it has been a long-standing practice to support the travel of the mayor and their spouse as they fulfill their duties, and that Putkatuk has small children, so it makes sense for him to travel with them. However, Patkatak's solo trips also racked up tens of thousands of dollars and included first-class tickets and luxury chauffeur services. When he attended a bond sale in New York in October, he was joined by 17 borough employees and some of their spouses. All of them flew first class, and the total travel expenses were more than $100,000. In response, Cox said that the New York trip was fully approved and was an opportunity for leadership to better understand how the borough funds infrastructure projects. No other borough code in Alaska mentions compensating officials for families' travel, and some boroughs specifically banned the practice. And in a dozen boroughs, officials are asked to use the most economical fare. If the petition charges are deemed recallable, the authors will need to collect enough signatures. The clerk would then submit the petition to the assembly and schedule an election within 90 days. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Lawmakers narrowly rejected an executive order from Governor Mike Dunleavy today that would have created a cabinet-level state agriculture department. Dunleavy's proposal would have split out the existing Division of Agriculture from the Department of Natural Resources. Dunleavy pitched it as a way to give farmers, ranchers, and other food producers a seat at the cabinet table, even after he's no longer governor. The combined House and Senate voted 32-28 to reject the proposal. Lawmakers in the largely Democratic coalitions that control the House and Senate said they supported the idea of a state agriculture department, but Representative Sarah Hannan, a Juneau Democrat, told her fellow lawmakers the governor's order was not the right approach.
Executive Order 136, as currently constructed and described before the Finance Committee, does not grow agriculture, it grows government. It appoints a commissioner, establishes administrative offices, and does not add $1 to our supports for food security.
Opponents said they would have preferred the governor introduce a bill creating the new department rather than an executive order. They say that's because there's little lawmakers can do to tweak an executive order in response to testimony from experts and the public. The most vocal supporter of the governor's agriculture department proposal has been Senator Shelley Hughes, a Palmer Republican. She chaired a legislative task force that wrote a lengthy report offering numerous recommendations for improving the state's food security.
Right now, if you were to open our report, you would see, Mr. President, that we did accomplish some things, but there's probably about 30 or so that we have not yet accomplished. And the only way they will be accomplished is if there's a Department of Agriculture, because you need someone to oversee that they happen.
In a statement on social media after the vote, Dunleavy thanked the lawmakers who supported his proposal. Some Republicans speculated after the vote that members of the largely Democratic majorities voted down the governor's order simply because they did not want to give Dunleavy a political win. Senate leaders rejected the accusation and said they planned to schedule hearings on bills that would create a state agriculture department in the near future. Fairbanks constituents of Senator Dan Sullivan organized a town hall to hear from him during the congressional spring break this week, but the hastily arranged event did not jibe with the senator's schedule and he was not able to appear. The organizers decided to hold the event anyway. KUIC's Robin reports.
There was an overflow crowd at Noel Wien Library's auditorium Monday night as about 175 people tried to squeeze in. A life-size portrait of Alaska's junior U.S. Senator, Dan Sullivan, was printed on cardboard and set up in the center of the room, where constituents could line up at two microphones and address him.
My name is Sarah Garland. Today, the administration crossed yet another line, a particularly terrifying one. They have now openly defied a legal ruling by the courts. And I want to know, Senator Sullivan, what are you going to do to try to preserve the foundation of our government?
This week, senators and representatives return to their home districts and very often hold constituent meetings. Kelly Barker described the organization of this one.
One person said we should do a town hall since Republicans are being told not to hold them, and we should hold one, and let's invite Senator Sullivan.
A spokesperson for Senator Sullivan said Monday that congressional offices have been flooded with calls and email messages asking about the many changes to federal jobs and spending made by the Trump administration, so much that it is hard to keep up. Barker said the Fairbanks group made calls to set up the constituent meeting, and it took more than a week to get a response.
Multiple times a day, calling every office number that we could find for him. And then one day at PAC, the offices, which happens every Monday at the federal building, someone put a flyer for the town hall event in Sullivan's door slot. And someone got a call after that. And they said, well, he won't be there. And the response was, well, we're going to hold it anyway.
The chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, Representative Richard Hudson of North Carolina, told GOP lawmakers 2 weeks ago to stop having town hall meetings because many were leading to public confrontations with angry constituents and could look bad and hurt them politically in midterm elections.
Right now, people are really angry, sad, uncertain, all those big feelings. We also do realize that, you know, his schedule's really packed and that this did happen at short notice. So I want to give that caveat there. At the same time, these are really tense times. And you're our senator. We feel like you should meet with us.
Sullivan's spokesperson did not want to be recorded, but would speak on background and said that many of these empty chair town halls across the country are set up just for social media fodder. Constituents at Monday's town hall say they were trying to reach the senator through his office first.
Senator Sullivan, hi, this is Shelby again. You should probably know my address by now. I leave you voicemails every single day. As a UPIC woman and 100% disabled veteran with countless combat flying hours, I think I've earned at least one answer, one response. This is Sarah Furman. My voice is probably familiar to you by now. I have a few questions. How are you going to protect the people of Alaska from the gutting of Social Security and Medicaid?
Yeah.
Where do you suggest the people of Fairbanks go for hospital services if the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital has to close its doors without these payments?
In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Senator Sullivan is set to address the Alaska legislature in Juneau tomorrow morning. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, despite tensions between the U.S. and Canada, a ski race near the border brings neighbors together.
We were saying it's like a diplomatic mission. We're coming up to get to see our neighbors and chat and just show support for each other, I think is super important to do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Federal investigators looking into the cause of a commercial passenger plane crash in early February on the sea ice of Norton Sound near Nome, killing all 10 on board, released their initial findings today. As KNOM's Ben Townsend reports, the National Transportation Safety Board report says the icy flight from Unalakleet to Nome was hundreds of pounds overweight.
When Bering Air Flight 445 crashed last month, fingers pointed to a number of potential causes, poor visibility, icy conditions, and a full flight among them. The National Transportation Safety Board's Alaska Region Chief, Clint Johnson, says it's too early to tell.
We're not ruling anything out, but I just don't want anybody to jump to conclusions, and the investigation is continuing.
But he says one thing does stick out, and that's weight.
There's no way around that. Unfortunately, our estimations are that the airplane was about 1,000 pounds over gross.
Now, that's gross weight. According to the report, the Cessna Caravan's maximum gross takeoff weight was about 1,000 pounds heavier than allowed for flight into the icy conditions that day. Searchers found the plane at a location 34 miles southeast of Nome a day after it crashed, with no survivors, on an ice floe moving 5 to 10 miles a day. As is standard procedure, investigators weighed baggage and cargo recovered from the site. They found that the cargo was nearly 100 pounds heavier than a Bering Air manifest documented. Still, Johnson says it isn't yet clear what specific role weight may have played in the plane's crash and how other factors might have been involved. He says his team of 15-plus investigators are diving into other systems recovered from the plane.
We're able to recover some avionics from the accident airplane that has given us a tremendous amount of information. We're still poring over that information at this point.
The report also brings some clarity to what happened in the lead-up to the fatal crash. It said the plane cruised toward Nome at 8,000 feet before starting a planned descent to 6,000 feet. An air traffic controller told the pilot the Nome airport would be closed for up to 15 minutes for de-icing and suggested that the pilot, quote, slow down a little bit. The pilot subsequently reduced the aircraft's speed and later changed course. Avionics data recovered by investigators show that in a matter of seconds, the aircraft reduced speed from 99 to 70 knots while cruising at just over 3,000 feet. Minutes later, third-party satellite data showed the plane at an altitude of 200 feet. Johnson says the team is still working on piecing together the sequence of events.
As far as the airspeed drop, the disconnect of the autopilot, was that pilot-induced? Was that automatically done? We don't know. but we are drilling down into that information as we speak right now to see if we can get a little bit better of an idea and understand the final moments of this flight.
The plane had landed upright with no evidence of an in-flight structural failure. The report says some ice was found along the wing's leading edges with significant icing on the tail. A final investigation report is expected to take at least a year to complete. That's when investigators will issue conclusions as to probable causes of the crash. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks has shuttered the office and taken down the website for an on-campus center that supported cultural programs and diversity-related training. But university officials say plans to integrate the center's work with other offices were in motion before the Trump administration targeted DEI programming at educational institutions nationwide. KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports.
Hudson Boldu is the former coordinator for the Nanook Diversity and Action Center. He says he quit toward the end of 2024 after his mentor advised him to look for a new job due to the political climate.
When you work in DEI, you're very aware of anti-DEI pushes, whether it's internal, external, the community, etc.
An interim coordinator held the position after Boldu, but they moved on from the Diversity and Action Center in January. Then, earlier this month, Boldu got a call from the Rasmussen Library at UAF.
To let me know that they were going to archive the website so that they could historically document what had taken place. And so that's right around when I found out everything was getting pulled and that the website would just link to the Wood Center.
For years, the Diversity and Action Center has helped facilitate professional development trainings, first-generation college student initiatives, LGBT student initiatives, and Heritage Month celebrations. Staff also organized drag shows and other campus events. An email sent Monday to the university community from University of Alaska President Pat Pitney names the Diversity and Action Center as one of the casualties of a Board of Regents motion that passed in February. That motion directed the university president and chancellors to scrub websites, print materials, position titles, and office titles of all diversity, equity, and inclusion terminology. The motion says that's to comply with federal guidance and executive orders. On March 10th, UAF Chancellor Dan White notified faculty, staff, and students that he was carrying out that directive, despite resistance, saying the risk of losing federal funding posed an existential threat to the university. UAF Communications Director Marmion Grimes says the university intends to roll some of the Diversity and Action Center's functions into the larger Center for Student Engagement. And while the university removed the Diversity and Action Center's website after the Board of Regents motion, she says the plan to close the center's physical office surfaced earlier. That decision came after the last staff member left in January, predating Trump's inauguration.
The bottom line is that there were some two positions eliminated over the course of this, you know, reorganization. But there were no employees that were, like, laid off or anything. When we had the last employee leave, we, you know, took that opportunity to put that savings, you know, towards other stuff.
For Boldu, watching his old workplace go dark in person and online was both expected and sad. But he says, one way or another, he expects the mission to persist.
Though the center can be removed, you can't really remove the fact that students, staff, faculty, we want to be able to promote safe spaces for students. We want to promote cultural diversity. We want to celebrate who is and who comes to UAF. So I don't think that will stop.
In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
Anchorage residents will not vote on a new sales tax this year. That's after the assembly voted 8-4 Tuesday night to kill a motion that would have put the issue on ballots for a special election in September. If approved by voters, the measure would have instituted a 3% sales tax on most goods, with 2/3 going to property tax relief and the remaining 1/3 going toward capital projects around the city. West Anchorage Assembly member Cameron Perez-Verdia said he supported the idea of a sales tax, but did not feel like the proposal on the table was the right one.
I don't think this is a responsible proposal to put before the voters. I think it is too complex. I think it is too difficult to understand. I think that we have not worked out all of the kinks.
The Assembly heard testimony on the proposed sales tax for months and held two town hall discussions on the topic this month. More than a dozen people provided public testimony on the proposal Tuesday night, most in opposition. Many described the sales tax as disproportionately impacting lower-income residents. Midtown Assemblymember Felix Rivera was one of the measure's sponsors. He said the city should continue to work on a sales tax that has input from a wide swath of residents.
The community should know that this conversation isn't over, that you will be asked at some point to say yes or no to a tax.
As the Assembly weighs the potential for a new sales tax proposal, Anchorage's next city election is set for April 1st. Half of the Assembly seats are up for election and four incumbents are not running.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Is it feasible for the proposed Alaska Long Trail from Seward to Fairbanks to become a national scenic trail? Not exactly, according to a draft study recently completed by the Bureau of Land Management. The BLM has been digging into the question since 2023 under direction from Congress. And on March 13th, the agency released a draft of the feasibility study for a 30-day public comment period. Charlie Ebers is a public affairs specialist with the BLM. He says the draft does not entail any concrete decisions and the BLM doesn't have control over whether the proposed route ultimately earns the National Scenic Trail designation. That power lies with Congress.
We'd like folks to read what we found and to add anything they think is pertinent that we may have missed. And we will take all that information and we will roll it up and we will send it to the Secretary of the Interior. The Secretary of the Interior will decide whether or not to move that up to Congress.
For its part, the study looks to evaluate the proposed 500-mile route against a series of objectives, outlining the desirability as well as physical and financial viability of labeling it a National Scenic Trail. The draft feasibility study says the proposed route meets or partially meets 8 of 9 objectives, falling short when it comes to approval of all relevant landowners.
There were segments along the way that people were really excited about, and there were segments on the way that people weren't necessarily interested in having a long trail cross.
But the Otna Native Corporation submitted a letter to the BLM opposing the Alaska Long Trail, saying it would exacerbate trespassing issues due to the section that would run through their lands in the southern part of Alaska's interior. In turn, the draft feasibility study states there is not currently a suitable end-to-end route from Seward to Fairbanks to be named a National Scenic Trail. But the study indicates that two shorter segments from Seward to Otna Land and from Otna Land to Fairbanks would fulfill all the objectives. The final day to send in public comment on the BLM's draft feasibility study is April 14th. President Donald Trump's trade war and comments about absorbing Canada into the U.S. have sparked concern in Alaska about the state's relationship with its closest neighbor. But how do Canadians feel? The Alaska Desk's Avery Elfelt spent last weekend at a long-standing Nordic ski race in British Columbia to find out.
It's Saturday morning and temperatures are hovering in the mid-teens. Haynes Maritime Morfitt is playing O Canada on a trumpet as cars stream into a parking lot along the Klondike Highway for the Buckwheat International Ski Classic. Among them is Whitehorse resident Carmen Gustafson. She's decked out in Canadian swag and says making the trip this year felt more important than ever.
Our idea was to still come, but we thought we'd like wear some flags and be patriotic. Yeah, and just let everybody know that things aren't really okay right now.
Buckwheat is a themed cross-country ski event that's been around for decades. The skiing happens in British Columbia, and the awards ceremony and after-party are held just across the border in Skagway. But the run-up to this year's event looked a little different. President Donald Trump has called multiple times for the annexation of Canada, conducted by, quote, economic force. He's also sparked a global trade war, in part by imposing 25% tariffs on some Canadian imports. The ordeal has led some Canadians to boycott spending money in or visiting the U.S. for the time being. For months, that's been top of mind for many in Alaskan border towns, including Jamie Bricker, Skagway's tourism director.
We've received a lot of correspondence from potential Canadian visitors that have expressed their frustration with the current situation and that they may not be able to visit Skagway until this is resolved itself.
The situation has pushed some local government officials to write letters and take other steps to show support for Canadians and encourage visits to Alaska amid escalating hostility. The week before the event, race organizers said the turmoil might lead fewer Canadians to register or to attend post-race events in Skagway.
Three, two, one!
But on race day, the parking lot is bustling. Roughly the same number of participants, around 270, registered this year as last year, and nearly 70% are Canadian. This year's theme is Creatures of the Deep, Enchantment of the Ski. So people arrive dressed as mermaids, octopus, jellyfish, and more. The real party gets going not long after the skiers take off at an aid station that sits in the middle of the course. It's about a 20-minute hike through the woods down a snow machine path. The party is in full swing. People stand around a fire, music blares, and volunteers serve burgers and beer from inside a giant snow fort carved with sea creatures. Whitehorse resident Gislay Delaplante is busy chasing his kids around the sculpture after wrapping up the race, but he stops for a minute to chat. He says Canadians are really angry with the U.S. government.
The tariffs obviously feels like a slap in the face, and then the talk about annexation and military intervention is absolutely disrespectful and not welcome.
But Delaplante adds that nobody at the race seems to be talking politics at all. He thinks that's because people are more interested in unity than antagonism and understand that federal policy has little to do with their friends in Alaska.
We love our American neighbors, and which is why this comes as such a shock and an offense.
Ed Gillis, also a Whitehorse resident, says there's a burgeoning movement in Canada to boycott the U.S., though he thinks that may pertain more to the lower 48 than Alaska. But that didn't impact his plans to attend Buckwheat this year, as he has for much of the last decade.
So we were going to miss it again this year just because everything that's going on. We were saying it's like a diplomatic mission. We're coming up to get to see our neighbors and chat and just show support for each other, I think is super important to do.
Gillis said he would go to the awards ceremony in Skagway, as he always does. That evening, the MC announced race winners and other awards, among them Best Costume. The prize is a free weekend in a cabin and a helicopter shuttle to get there. This year, it went to a Whitehorse resident who raced as a floating island of trash.
To the plastic island.
Just over the Canadian border near Skagway, I'm Avery Elfelt.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Alona Nyden, Chris Clint and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Juneau, Robin and Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Avery Elfelt over there across the border in Canada. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Matson, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at matson.com/Alaska.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
I was nurtured, I was sheltered, I was curious and young.
searching for that something, trying to find it on the ride. Oh, and just when I stopped looking, I saw just how far I'd come in this life. Distance to make a difference has let me save into your hands in this life.
When the wind was so cold that my body froze in bed, if I just listened to it right outside the window. There were days when the sun was so cruel that all the tears turned to dust, and I just knew my eyes were drying up forever. I finished crying in the instant that you left, and I can't remember where or when or how. And I banished every memory you and I had ever made. just have to admit that it's all coming back to me when I touch you like this and I hold you like that. It's so hard to believe, but it's all coming back to me. It's all coming back. It's all coming back to me now. There were moments of gold and there were flashes of light. There were things I'd never do again, but then they'd always seem to right. There were nights of endless pleasure. It was more than just went on for days. When alone at last we count up all the chances that will last to us forever.
Forever.
But you were history with the slamming of the door. And I made myself so strong again somehow. And I never wasted any. Kiss me like that. It was so long ago, but it's all coming back to me. If you touch me like this, and if I kiss you like that, it was gone with the wind, but it's all coming back to me.
It's all coming back, it's all coming back to me now.
There were moments of gold. Of light. There were things we could never do again, but then they'd always seem right. There were nights of endless pleasure. It was more than all your loss and love. Baby, 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 when you touch me like this, when you hold me like that, you was gone with the wind, but it's all coming back to me. When you see forgive you all that. We forgive and forget, and it's all coming back to me. When you see me like this, and when I see you like that, we see just what we want to see, all coming back to me. The flesh and the fantasies all coming back to me. I can barely recall.
Seems like I'm always in the That's my claim to fame.